A 6-game, 13-day road trip to open the season, and finally the Canucks get to play at home. They return home a team that is above 500, and we have the latest episode of the VanCast, Farhan Lalji and Thomas Drantz joining you. Drantzer, it's good to see you the other day in Seattle, and it's going to be exciting to see you tomorrow night here in Vancouver.
Oh, I'm really excited to see what this building looks like again with fans. Like, we've watched so many games there last season, you know, and during the preseason with 50%, like the idea that this building could be close to full. Now, I think there are tickets available. We've seen that tickets are not, like, games are not selling out across Canada right now. And I think that reflects that while, you know, the authorities are permitting people to fill these buildings, there's still a confidence crisis coming out of the pandemic, like a confidence crisis as it pertains to how safe people actually feel attending one of these games. But, you know, the idea that there's going to be atmosphere, real fan atmosphere at Rogers Arena, like, that has me hyped for this week, Farhan.
Well, before we get to the game that is, let's talk about the games that were, and also the road trip that was for you, because it was 13 days. You know, we're making the point that you're actually more excited to see Wallace, your dog, than you are necessarily to see your wife.
No.
Who's lovely, by the way. Everybody should know
this. Yeah, she's the best.
What was it like for you to get back on the road for an extended period of time after essentially 2 years when you were in the bubble last, or a year and a half?
Yeah, you know, Farhan, it is weird traveling right now. Like, it is a little strange, and I know you do it a fair bit for football, but, things feel normal. But they're not, right? Like, it's very clearly not normal. It's very clearly not over. You know, the masks, the testing. I mean, I dreaded. My biggest fear the whole time was that I'd test positive on, like, right before heading back over the border and be subject to a lengthy quarantine in Seattle, right? And, I mean, that was, like, my nightmare was that this 13-day trip would become a month-long trip, right? A month away from my wife and my dog, which I really didn't want to do, particularly with yesterday being Wallace's first birthday. So, you know, it was interesting to navigate. And obviously we saw that play out at the team level too, right? I mean, John Garrett, of course, was not on the broadcast because of protocols. You know, my understanding is that the presence, like the protocol presence in the wake of Garrett entering, resulted in some members of the Canucks traveling party, like one member of Canucks hockey operations staff, in addition to an additional security staffer, being effectively sent home as close contacts, right? Like, the team's taking no chances. We're interacting with players face to face, but, you know, in a sort of very specific type of way where I'm still masked up. I still don't have my, like, full device of my face to emote, you know, and draw certain responses from guys, which can be a little tricky. But, you know, fundamentally, to get back on the road, to be back covering live hockey, to be back watching hockey games in full buildings, and to be back getting, you know, quotes and having conversations with players, right? I mean, you know, you look at the Garland piece, for example, that I wrote off of the home opener. Like, that piece is not possible to do last year, you know? And I think it gives fans a really good sense of who this guy is. Like, that's the type of piece you want to write. Like, associating a moment with a guy, his personality, his work ethic, the chip on his shoulder, and then providing it so that fans have this deeper appreciation for a moment that they already enjoyed. Like, that's the work that you love to do in this business. That was work we couldn't do last year. So I'm so grateful to be able to do it now. And yet, you know, the Canucks play the Blackhawks and then they have three guys enter the protocol, right? And then you test, and all indications that I got last night were that, you know, there's no concern. I don't think there's any positives among the Canucks group. That's great news. You know, clearly the vaccines have not just cut down on severe cases or cases even with symptoms among NHL players, as we saw with Nathan MacKinnon, who was asymptomatic and noted that the vaccine must be working, but also, you know, has stopped the type of team-to-team transmission that we did see on occasion last year, you know, especially between the Buffalo Sabres and the New Jersey Devils. Like, that's great to see. That gives me a lot of confidence that we're going to have a normal-ish season, even though we don't know what's coming down the pike vis-a-vis additional sort of mutations and what have you. But, you know, I do think we're going to get through this hockey season. I do think it's going to be abnormal, but more recognizable than what we've had in the past. And, you know, I'm grateful to be able to go out on the road covering those games, even though it's not quite the same, right? Like, it's not quite what it was. And also, I would add this, after 18 months basically spent, you know, largely at home, right, with my wife working from home, like not going to the office like she used to, and me not hitting the road like I used to. And when I did hit the road for Edmonton, I brought her. You know, I missed my family more this time just because I wasn't used to being away from them the way that I had been in my usual hockey nomad lifestyle prior to the pandemic. So it was definitely an interesting experience here, Farhan.
Yeah, and for me, I had the family away in the other direction because my son was playing in a hockey tournament in Sycamouche. They got back yesterday. I didn't go up because I wanted to be in Seattle for that game and knew that it was a bit of a historic event and, you know, just the chance to go there for a franchise opener and in a building opener, which was an electric building, by the way. But and then I had a chuckle when we went downstairs and Travis Green saw me in the little press room and had a chuckle himself. Said, oh, look what the cat dragged in.
I think he was just relieved to see a face that wasn't mine.
Yeah, it could be. It absolutely could be. But let's start with the Seattle game and just the building, the atmosphere, the scene. Wow, just seeing that atmosphere, it just looked fabulous on so many levels, right? I mean, you knew that everybody had a sense of just what a historic day was going to be, but just looking at the crowd itself, the amount of branding that had been done, the amount of jerseys that had been worn, it looked like an organic hockey crowd. It didn't look like a manufactured hockey crowd or a corporate hockey crowd, if you know what I'm saying, right? I mean, we've had that in Vancouver from time to time where it just wasn't as loud and noisy because it was full of, you know, suits, right? Whereas this was nothing like that. And just the vibe in that building was a special thing to be a part of.
It felt on concourse level walking in, because you do have to go through the concourse to get up to that press box or down to the event level for the media meal, which, you know, I didn't skip. You know, when you walked through and saw all the all the fans in jerseys, I mean, it was a powerful display, right? From one of the great sports cities on this continent. Like, it was awesome. It felt like an army. Like, the Seattle fans came out and they felt like an army. And then they were as loud as any fans that I've heard in any building in a non-playoff game, maybe ever live. Like, it was awesome. It was a great environment. Tremendous. Like, tremendous work. Kudos to Seattle. I love talking to some of the fans on the concourse, too. People who are like, I'm not even a hockey fan. I'm just so excited. And it's like, oh, you'll be a hockey fan. Like, this is, it's just a matter of time. And yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be a big win for Canucks fans who get to travel down there and watch games in that great venue once the border opens, but also, you know, just for the NHL. Like, I think it's going to be awesome to have a hockey team in that market. They seem ready to embrace it and then some.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the moment where they can actually talk about hockey, because coming back and listening to the postgame show after we were done, it was just, it was kind of like what it was in Chicago when the franchise first turned the corner and Taves and Kane came and they, you know, the franchise there was, you know, just very morbid, and you looked at it and thought, how is this going to survive? But then the ownership situation happened and all of a sudden fans started getting re-engaged. But when you listened to it, they couldn't talk about hockey in any kind of meaningful way. It was about their own team. And in this case, it's about, they can't even talk about their own team yet because they don't even know them. It's just about how great this is to have the team here and the newness of it all, as opposed to actually being able to talk about the game one way or the other in any form of critical way. So, you know, I'm looking forward to the crowd getting educated about the sport at this level, their own team, and then what the rest of the league looks like and who's important. But as far as what we saw on that night, you saw a Canuck team that actually came out really well for the first 15 minutes or so, and then they took that one penalty. I think it was Lamico who took the penalty late in the first period, and from that point on, for a meaty period of time, they were getting run out of the building.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the game, I looked back and I thought, you know what? On the whole, the Canucks weren't as bad as I felt like they were through so much of the game. But that's what happens when you go 16 minutes without a shot in the second period. Like, other than the second period, they were the better team in the first and the third. It just never felt like that, because when the Canucks start to get stuck in their own end, it's like, you know, minutes pass, like whole minutes pass, where there's just nothing going on but survival, right? Like, just hanging on by their fingernails. And that happened to them in the middle of the middle of this game. I do think Seattle controlled this for the most part, right? And they created that probably should have been game winner, the 2-1 goal in the third period, by, you know, just repeatedly. And it was repeatedly, especially on that left side of the defense, where the Canucks were just getting stuck at the red line and puck was coming back and coming back fast. And, you know, Seattle was punishing that. They just weren't quite capitalizing. Finally, they did. And then the Canucks get, you know, Juho Lamico makes up for the bad penalty he took in the first, draws one. Bo Horvat, gritty goal. Who else would have scored it but Bo, right? I mean, I told him postgame, did you see that exchange between me and Bo postgame where he came in and the Zoom wasn't quite ready? And I was just like, yep. You always score in loud buildings. And he's like, I'll take it. that was funny. Who else would have done that, right? Like, he is really brandishing his resume as this, like, big game player. And this was a big game. Like, this was the biggest game that the Canucks have played with fans in attendance in a decade, frankly. You know, this, in terms of national eyeballs and attention and it mattering in a wider historical sense, like, this was a big game. Horvat came to play. They tie it up. And then what was interesting was the pressure that was just withering from the Kraken before the Garland game winner, right? They again can't get it out. The Kraken come in, and this time they just overcommitted and Garland made them pay. But it was like, that was the key dynamic, was the Canucks getting stuck in the Kraken pressing. And the fact that the game winner was created on that sequence, just with Garland counterattacking. And it was a really great individual effort, not just the goal and not just the race. But if you go look and watch him knife the puck away from Kelly Yarncroc, and then it's his pressure that creates the bad pass from Jaden Schwartz. Like, that was all Garland. All Garland. That was not luck. That was not a fortunate bounce, and he was fresh. Like, Garland created that break entirely and then finished it off with a pretty cunning move to fool Philip Grubauer. I mean, overall, when I look at that game, the Canucks didn't play well. Or well enough. They certainly didn't inspire confidence. I'm still enormously concerned by the way that they're getting stuck in their own end on a repeated basis by any team with average speed. But I do think when you look at when you sort of zoom out and try and not emotionally react to the 16 minutes we saw in the second or some of those lengthy shifts that the Kraken were able to engineer in the third, like, the Canucks were probably on balance, aside from those stretches, you know, better than we felt in real time.
Those were long stretches. And before we dive deeper into Garland and a few of the other things around that, they got through it because of Thatcher Demko. Now, Thatcher being Thatcher, probably wanted the second goal back, maybe. But beyond that, the guy was electric. I mean, we've seen bubble Demko. I know we're beyond that. He doesn't like hearing that, but he looked pretty good throughout this game.
Oh, more than pretty good. He was incredible. I thought that was, you know, like in Edmonton, I thought that was, you know, those are stolen points. I mean, some of those saves were magnificent, unlikely, incredible. And when you look through what Demko's done now at this point, like, among NHL goaltenders that have faced at least 30 high danger scoring chances per natural stat trick, Demko has an 870 save percentage on high danger chances. He's faced 55 of them. In five games. So he's facing 11 per game on average. He's stopping almost 90% of them. That's a figure that leads all NHL goaltenders, right? And where would this Canucks team be without that? I mean, truly, he's been their best player, frankly. As good as Garland has been, as good as Hughes has been on in moments when he's been, you know, not in the lineup or when he's been in the lineup, you know, no question for me. Thatcher Demko is Vancouver's best player through the first, you know, road trip anyway.
Meanwhile, we were at Climate Pledge Arena. We had a climate denier in the form of Travis Green after the game saying, wait a minute, we didn't have him for that many high danger chances.
Oh, that was the Seattle game?
Yeah, like he was denying how much they were underwater at times throughout the game. But just when he was asked about the number of high danger chances against, he didn't agree with the stats.
Well, the Canucks have their own internal stuff, right? I mean, the Canucks, you know, for example, like, Travis Green's conversant in expected goals. Like, expected goals is a topic that he understands, is conversant in weights in terms of how he rates players and makes decisions. Like, that, it's something that he looks at and cares about. But he doesn't call it that. Like, that's not what it's called, because the internal reports have their own, you know, way of describing it. I don't remember or know offhand what exactly he calls it, but it's not what I'd call it, which is expected goals, or what the public would call it, which is also expected goals. So, you know, it's an interesting dynamic. And yeah, I mean, he's got different numbers. Like, he's got different numbers that he's looking at. Sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't. And, you know, I'd expect, frankly, considering the intelligence of the people that the Canucks employ in that analytics department, right, which is sort of led by John Wall and then Aiden Fox. You've got Ryan Beach, and they added a gentleman named Miles Hokin to the group this offseason. You know, that's I would tend to favor their metrics over the publicly available ones that rely mostly on location data, right? And are put together by spiders as opposed to a guy manually checking the information every time it happens, right? So, you know, and when you do have those moments, it's not a surprise, right? It's not a surprise. And I tend to give precedence personally. And this is not me deferring to authority. Like, this is just based on what I know of what goes into how the sausage is made for the publicly available data versus, you know, what I'd expect goes into the sausage being made internally for the Canucks. Like, I'd probably weight the internal data a little more heavily than I weight what we tend to be looking at on a game-to-game basis.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Great article by you in The Athletic on Connor Garland. And you had a chance to talk to some of his former teammates, including Keith Yandel, among others that he spent time with in the Boston area. And just, they talked a lot about A, his nonstop work ethic, and B, his competitiveness at everything he does. You know, you talked to him a little bit about it afterwards. And, you know, even as something as simple as a fan giving him the finger at the bench completely gets this guy's engine cranked.
Yeah. Garland is, it doesn't seem to take a lot to get Garland hyped up. Like, I talked to Ryan Donato, who was just carving his buddy, right? Says he brings a trophy to the golf course. Like, I loved that. I just thought that was such a funny note. You know, and then he tells me that Garland will sometimes not speak to him for the rest of the day if he loses at golf. And I brought it up to Garland after the Zoom, and I thought his reaction was just amazing. He's like, no. Well, okay, there was one incident in the summer, but he cheated. And it's just like, oh man, like, that's, you're that guy. And that guy is a good thing. It's just a good thing, you know, it's a good insight into what makes a guy who went undrafted, who is undersized, who plays the game this way, who has no problem pissing off everybody who's on the other side, right? It's a good insight into why he's wired the way he's wired. And he's obviously wired a little bit differently, even with the way he plays. I thought his comments on playing a unique style seemed really self-aware, right? Like, he does play a unique style. He does these weird spins along the wall. Like, his entire approach to creating space and slowly working the puck out front of the net is, you know, deliberate and individual in a way that, like, I've very rarely seen. And, you know, I just, there's something up there. He's a really fascinating guy to watch. Definitely a fascinating guy to talk to, and he's especially a fascinating guy to talk to others about, which was sort of the meat of that piece. And I was really happy with it. I was really happy with the reaction. So thanks to everyone in that comment section who left such nice comments about it. Like, you know, when I talk about being able to do those face-to-face conversations, like, truly it's the comments that are like, you know, this made me appreciate who Garland was as a person. Like, there you go. That's that, the long hours, the work, like, that's the moment you're looking for in this business sometimes, right? Is to create that deeper appreciation. So, I was really happy with that piece. And I thought the Garland moment, the goal, the stare down, you know, it all sort of pretty neatly encapsulated everything I'd heard about the guy, which is that, you know, he's a hardworking guy, and he's as competitive as they come.
2 years ago, we talked about having a guy like JT Miller and the importance of having somebody who could drag the rest of the team into the fight. Connor Garland strikes me as that guy, and this club could use more of it.
Yeah. Well, he's also really good, right? Like, that's such an important part. Like, this is a top line rate scorer. You know, it's amazing, for example, Farhan, that he's scored as much as he has. He's over point per game. He's not on PP1. Like, he's not doing this with the benefit of, you know, a bunch of power play secondary assists. Like, this is all hard points. That makes what he's doing a little bit more impressive for me anyway, right? Like, if you're getting a guy who's producing like this, leading your team in scoring, and it's not, you know, off of just like outside puck movement that ends up going into the net off of a rebound, like, it's pretty incredible, right? Like, that's a big weapon, a big weapon. Obviously, he's been full value for the Canucks in the early going.
Yeah, the good setup on the Bo Horvat goal, but do you get the sense that overall that individual style is meshing completely yet with Horvat and Pearson?
I don't think it is, no. And you know what? I'm not sure it will. Like, I'm not ultimately sure if that's going to be a fit, but look, they seem to think they're making progress. I think they had three really good games on this road trip overall, and one was Buffalo, one was Chicago, and one was Seattle. So, you know, three of the last four have been really good games for that line. But, you know, I didn't think they did much in Buffalo, to put it mildly. Philadelphia and Edmonton, they certainly were underwater on the shot clock. And when you look overall at the numbers, I mean, we're talking about 65 minute sample. So, like, we're not talking about a ton of predictive or evaluative value here, but, you know, it's like a 42% expected goals rate. Like, that's really not what you're looking for from a line with players as talented as Horvat and Garland on it. So, you know, work in progress. I want to see them play probably another 35 to 40 minutes together before I start to say, like, hey, they should separate this line. The results haven't been bad enough that I'd say it's not working. They certainly haven't been good enough that I'd say there's a lot of potential here. I think they've been sort of in that range where the offense has been there and the moments have been there, but the just consistency hasn't. And that to me is just like getting, you know, that's consistent with getting some, you know, chemistry, building that chemistry slowly between the trio. So we'll see where this goes. But yeah, I mean, to this point, I don't think that line's been like a killer, even though they had a great night in Seattle.
Meanwhile, another line that hasn't seemed to be figuring it out, because, you know, when you look at this line, I mean, Garland and Horvat and Pearson, just from a production standpoint, has been somewhat carrying the team, even though they haven't necessarily meshed. But we've got the Pedersen line. Boy, this group, I mean, is it as simple as just saying that Petey just was late to camp and it's been his first game in 8 months and we've got no problems here? Is there any reason for anybody to be concerned about how that group is playing and how Pedersen individually is playing?
Yeah, I think the Pedersen thing is difficult to unpack. And I talked to him. There's a piece up at The Athletic today, why I'm not worried yet about Elias Pedersen and other observations from the Canucks 6-game road trip. And here's somewhat he told me, Farhan. This was on Saturday. He said, my game is definitely not where I want it to be. It's early in the year. I want to play my best hockey in every game. My game is not exactly where I want it to be yet, but it's only game 6 tonight. I know I'll find my game eventually and play to the level I expect. And that sort of raises the question of how much time do the Canucks have here? Talking through it with him, like, it did sound like the confidence isn't quite there for him right now. Like, he's not feeling like, you know, the imperious alpha point producer that he does, like, that he feels like when he's at his best. Like, he there's something missing there for him on the ice day to day. And, you know, not a huge surprise based on what we've seen, but, you know, he also refuses to make excuses about missing camp, right? Like, he said to me, yeah, maybe, when I brought up the missing camp factor and, more importantly, the missing 8 months factor. And he said, the situation, though, is what it is. I miss camp. Like, we're past that. I'm just doing the best I can. And we were doing the best we could to prepare for the season. I just haven't found the game I want yet. And so we're, you know, at this point where the lotto line's really not spinning. And, like, how crazy is this, Farhan? Like, this was one of the best two-way lines in hockey over the last 2 years. Through 20 minutes, only 20 minutes, like, they only got thrown together in the Buffalo game. So it's been two games or not even two games, because they got separated midway through the Seattle game. So it's been 20 minutes of 5-on-5 ice time with those three together. 23% expected goals rate per money puck with those three on the ice together. 23%. Like, that's wild. They haven't given up a goal against. They haven't scored a goal for. I think there have been moments where I can see the forechecking game that they lean on so heavily begin to crank into gear. But the quick strike offense, the finishing, that stuff's not been there. And neither has their ability to play in the offensive end. Like, they have been on their heels when they've been on the ice together to this point in those 20 minutes. You know, I said that the level that the Horvat Garland line was at, like, necessitated some patience. 23%, like, man, that's a rate where they're on a short leash. Like, I'm not surprised, knowing that now, that they got separated so early in that Kraken game. And I'd be really, really tempted, I think, that I'd be tempted to split the line. Honestly, it's so bad. It's so bad, even though the sample is so small, that I'd just be like, nope, I don't think so. You know, you guys want to play together. You earn that back by having some heavy shifts with different line mates. And, you know, the other thing that I'd be really thinking about if I was the Canucks would be, you know, getting Elias Pettersson going is pretty much the most important thing that this team has to do, right? They have one guy right now in the lineup who, no matter who you put him with, that player is going to get their chances. Who's that player, Farhan?
Nils Höglander.
Nils Höglander. So if Nils Höglander is Mr. Fix-It, and the most important thing you've got to fix and get going is Elias Pettersson, like, put them together. And they did that against Seattle, but, you know, they were playing with Matthew Highmore. Like, give them JT. Give them JT on left wing, Pettersson, Höglander. I'd be going with that. I know that's a tough beat for Brock Besser, but, you know, that's how it's probably going to work all season. Like, one forward is going to be playing pretty regularly outside the top six because, you know, if Pearson's always with Horvat, you sort of got seven top six forwards. Like, one guy's always going to be driving the bus elsewhere. Besser's a guy who's had success driving other lines. He's a smart enough player that he can set guys up. You know, I'd put him down elsewhere right now because I'm just not concerned about him. Like, he's going to be fine. I think he's playing well. I think he's going to get his chances and help manufacture chances for other players. But, like, getting Pettersson going is pretty much everything. Like, the whole ball game for this Canucks team right now, I'd consider going with something like Miller, Pettersson, Höglander, if only to just, like, get Pettersson feeling good. Like, to get him to a point where he's having fun again. Because once he's having fun, then, you know, you're going to start to see the best of Pettersson, and then you're going to have, you know, your ace in the deck. Right now, the Canucks are trying to win without their ace, and that ain't easy in any sort of trump game.
Yeah, there's no question, but when I look at it also, one of the reasons they put those guys back together, yes, we know Brock Besser missed the first four games, but in addition, I think they put them together to get Petey going. And certainly in terms of solutions, I like yours better than the alternative, which is take JT Miller off that line, which means JT Miller goes back to center, which is not good at any time. So I don't want to see that happen at any point this year, although we know that it is inevitable at some point. But is there something specific you see missing? Like, I just don't see, forget the goals. You know, he had a dynamic style, a creativeness to his game that he doesn't even seem to be attempting it at this point in terms of his ability to carry the puck and make things happen for himself. He always used to create his own chances. It wasn't necessarily what he did back and forth with Miller and Besser. It was just, he had that it factor, especially that first year. And I don't even see him attempting to make those kinds of plays.
I don't see him carrying the puck the same way. Like, he just doesn't have the puck the way that he usually has, right? And that's why I spotlighted today, like, he hasn't drawn a penalty 5-on-5. And more than that, like, when Petey's been on in the past, Farhan, you remember the experience of watching Pettersson get, like, hauled down and there's no call? And that happens, like, once a period, and you're like, man, they have to call that. You know? Like, we're not even seeing that, because he just doesn't have the puck the way that he usually has. It's hard to diagnose exactly what's up. But the two things that stand out to me is he just doesn't have the puck as much as he usually has because he's not drawing penalties. Like, that's what that tells us. And the other is his shot attempt rate is down like 60% from where it was in 2019-20. And that to me is the bigger concern, because what does that tell us about the comfort level that he's dealing with regarding his wrist, right? Like, that's the real sort of rub here, like the thing that keeps me a little bit concerned, because a lot of Pettersson's concerns are percentage based, right? Like, he hasn't converted a single 5-on-5 shot. He's the second best 5-on-5 finisher in the NHL going into the season for the last 3 years. Like, only Dreisaitl has converted a higher rate of 5-on-5 shots over large samples than Pettersson. Like, that's, you know, not going to last. He's going to finish. You know, his on-ice shooting percentage is under 5%. Like, that's unsustainable unless you're Daniel Winnick or Scott Gomez or something like that, like a guy with no finish at all, much less a guy with Pettersson's, you know, characteristic pinpoint accuracy, that will bounce back. If both of those numbers were at his sort of career norms, like, he'd be a point per game player and we wouldn't be talking about this. And that would require no change to his overall two-way form. So part of this is bad luck, but there are a couple things I'm concerned about. And the two things I'm eyeing in particular are that shot attempt rate and the penalty drawn rate, because I think those tell us, or those at least pose some pretty interesting questions. One about his overall health, and the other about, you know, how much he's actually handling the puck in game. I just don't see, you know, the level of dominance and battle winning that I have tended to in his NHL career to this point.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because there were times early last year where I felt the same way early in the season, where he just wasn't taking those shots, especially on the power play. And I know that a few that he took wound up hitting iron, and everybody said that's the real issue. You know, and it just looked a little different than what it had looked like the previous year. But eventually his shot, the number of attempts came back, that confidence came back. And so I'm kind of putting it into that context that he's been through this before, just in terms of his desire to let it rip, especially on the power play. But eventually it came back, and you've got to believe it's going to at some point here. But I'm curious to see if he'd ever cop to the health side of it.
No, I wouldn't assume he would. I mean, his comment on his wrist over the summer was like, you know, going into it, I was a little bit concerned, but as I worked through with my shot over the summer, there was, you know, nothing encumbering me. There was no pain. And so, you know, I think he sort of said his piece, but I mean, it's not just the shot rate. It's the attempts that are down massively in all situations. And, you know, that's just something to watch for. Like, maybe we'll see it go up. Maybe it's just small sample noise. That's very possible. But, you know, when we know that there's an external potential health-related explanation, right? I do think it's something we look at a little bit differently than just being like, well, that's noise, or like, oh, it just has to shoot more. Like, I think it poses some more interesting questions. The data does, anyway.
So the Canucks end their first road trip to begin the season here 3-2-1. And what was interesting is that after game four, that effort in Buffalo where Travis Green challenged his team in the biggest way. I mean, he was all over them. You were at the practice when they got skated really hard before the Chicago game. And they came out in that Chicago game, and it wasn't necessarily very good in the early going. And then they had the Tanner Pearson deflected goal. You talked about that in The Athletic as well. What's your overall takeaway from this road trip? Because, you know, they lost the Detroit game, which they clearly should have won. The Buffalo game was a debacle. You know, they had some moments underwater against Seattle. They didn't start well against Chicago. What's your takeaway through six games?
Yeah, I think, one thing I can't figure out, Farhan, right now is, like, in terms of the run of play, right? In terms of the run of play, the Canucks are not doing that badly. Like, they're a middling 5-on-5 team in terms of the run of play. That's sort of a level at which, if their special teams can be good and if they get good goaltending and if they can finish, which I think we expect this group of forwards to be able to do, you know, then they're going to be, you know, definitely a playoff team or close to it, right? Like, really close to it. If that logic holds, they're going to be fine. However, when you account for shot location, right, they're the third worst expected goals differential team in the early going this season, ahead of only Columbus and Anaheim. Like, that's not the company you want to be keeping. And so there's a really big gap, like a wider than usual gap, between what the Canucks are managing in terms of zone time and what they're managing in terms of the quality of looks they're generating versus what they're surrendering. And the biggest impact on that is the offense. Like, they're just not generating nearly enough 5-on-5. You know, the defense, I'm not saying the defense has been like great shakes. They're not the, you know, Lou Lamoriello New Jersey Devils or anything, but like, offensively is where the differential gap is really sort of come to bear. That to me is the biggest concern. You know, can this team start to generate chances again? You know, I think we expect them to, because I think we expect Pettersson to round into form. I think we maybe are even seeing the Bo Horvat line round into form. That will help. Like, that's what they're really missing, is consistent, sustained offensive push from their top six. Without it, this team is not a playoff team. Like, period. Like, they need to get that going, and they need to get it going fast because, you know, Minnesota's coming in here on Tuesday. Like, Minnesota controls play really well, better than almost anyone in the league. Like, this Minnesota team is really imposing 5-on-5. Probably the best that the Canucks have faced yet. Like, not probably. The best 5-on-5 team the Canucks have faced yet is coming in on home for the Canucks home opener. Like, that's going to be a really big test. They cannot struggle to generate high danger looks offensively against Minnesota the way that they have against other teams, or they're going to get shut out. Like, they're going to lose decisively unless they can do that. So for me, that's sort of one big thing that this club needs to do. The other thing that I'm still concerned about, you know, we see all this disorganization or looks of disorganization at times here and there for the Canucks game at 5-on-5. And for me, Farhan, part of that is I wonder how much confidence the forwards have in the defense to make the right plays. Like, are they confident blowing the zone? Are they confident, you know, skating, knowing that a pass is going to hit them, even if they're 25, 30 yards away from their defensemen who aren't Quinn Hughes and Oliver Ekman-Larsson? I'm not sure. Like, I do think we're seeing the seams and a lot of the problems that we're seeing from the Canucks' neutral zone game, the inability to break out, you know, a lot of those sort of issues. Like, a lot of them come back to me and people are like, why is this team so disorganized? And I'm looking at it and I'm being like, what do you expect with this blue line personnel? Like, you know, when I was talking about it as an Achilles heel and talking about the struggles transitioning and how hard it is to spend time in your own end or in the offensive end when your defense isn't, you know, up to snuff. I mean, a lot of that looks the way that I'd expected it to or worried that it might. To me, even though the results have been more favorable for the Canucks over six games, like, I do think we're seeing problems in that area in particular. And that's an area where there's no easy fix.
You mentioned the Canucks game against the Wild. It's the first of a 7-game homestand, which we will dive into when the show returns. So, Drancher, it's the Canucks and Wild on Tuesday night, the first of 7 games. They follow that up by taking on the Flyers on Thursday. They host the Oilers on Saturday. Rangers, Predators, Stars, and Ducks also on the menu. And you mentioned, I mean, the Wild are a team that they hold on to the puck. They know how to control the puck and play in the opposition end. You know, what do the Canucks need to change, and how much will matchups potentially help this team right now?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I do think we're going to see, especially once they come home and Travis Green has last change, like, I do think this is especially where paradoxically we're going to notice the absence of guys like Brandon Sutter and Tyler Mott in the event that he's not back in time for Tuesday, which at this point I don't expect, considering that he didn't join them on the road trip. You know, I do think that this is an area where and especially against the Wild, like, having a bottom six group that's, you know, held together by, you know, I don't want to say ticky tack, but certainly is, you know, has a lot of bodies, like a lot of Highmores, a lot of Lamacos, a lot of Chason types on it, could be a bit of a problem, especially because the Wild come at you, you know, and in their bottom six, you know, they've got guys like, you know, Nico Sturm and Marcus Foligno and Nick Bjugstad, like, guys who can do damage offensively. This is going to be a real test for Vancouver's bottom six, like, against Minnesota. That's sort of the first thing that stands out. Obviously, we know what Kaprizov can do. We know what Zuccarello can do. We know what Fiala can do. Like, they're dangerous pieces. But, you know, for me, where the danger is going to be greatest against this Wild team is that they've got bottom six pieces that can do real damage offensively. How the Canucks contain that and match up with that, I think, is going to be a real test. And it's going to be a real test, not just for the forwards, but also for Burrows and Rathbone and perhaps Luke Shen, who, you know, we'll see a lot of those minutes, probably Rathbone and Burrows at this point, right? Like, I don't think there's a ton of suspense there in terms of the makeup of Vancouver's third pair. So, yeah, that's the one thing that I'm looking at with Minnesota in particular, is how does Vancouver's bottom six handle the offensive threat posed by some of the depth forwards that Minnesota's going to ice. You know, I want to talk about Seattle really quick, by the way. How weird was that experience on Saturday morning at the morning skate, like, listening to them figure out last minute preparations, like the sound of hammering ringing through event level?
Yeah, it was different.
like it, clearly there was a ton to do.
They needed every minute. The fact that this team opened up on the road for 2 weeks because they needed the extra time. When you look at even when the television cabling went down, it was like 4 a.m. before the game, following up the two concerts. They needed every minute to get ready.
Yeah. And so what does it tell you that they needed every minute and the NHL still gave the Canucks 3 additional days? like the only other team that hasn't played a home date yet is the New York Islanders, and they don't do it till November 20th. Like, their building is under construction right now. And yet the Canucks will be, other than the Islanders, the last team to play a home date. And that's obviously the league sort of looking at sizing up the jurisdiction of British Columbia, which has been the trickiest for them to deal with throughout this pandemic, and understanding that if the Canucks wanted to sell out their building, like, they needed as much time as they possibly could have been given. They were given maximum time. And how amazing is it? Like, the 50% limit on indoor attendance is lifted a day before the Canucks home opener. Like, the Canucks needed every hour to get to the point where they'd be able to fill Rogers Arena, or at least be entitled to fill Rogers Arena based on the laws of the land. You know, that to me, like, as we watch those preparations, that's sort of one thing that really stuck out to me. Like, for all the work I see going on right now, like, the Canucks were the team that needed more time than this. Like, that kind of blew me away when I was sort of thinking it through on Saturday.
Yeah, it's a great point. And certainly when the timing of Dr. Bonnie Henry's announcement came regarding and the provincial government, and that announcement came regarding capacity for indoor events. I mean, yeah, you certainly had to look at the date and know that this was all kind of planned around this. What do you expect Canuck fans to respond like, right? I mean, do you expect this? You know, we talk about the ability to sell it out. These things do take time. They don't instantly, you flip the switch and all of a sudden, you know, 18,000 people are here, especially when you consider that when this team played last, it wasn't that simple because they weren't necessarily that good. Does the fact that absence makes the heart grow fonder and people have been waiting to get to sporting events, like, how much do you expect that to impact their attendance?
Yeah, I mean, I do expect it to impact their attendance without question. Like, I mean, we've seen it in Toronto, we've seen it in Montreal, we've seen it across Canada that, you know, just because you're allowed to fill the building doesn't mean you can, right? There is still, you know, a real lack of confidence in, you know, the overall marketplace. I don't know, like, I know my parents would no chance they'd be comfortable going to a venue, like, no chance. And so, you know, I'm sure that's true for a lot of people. And that's sort of what we're still up against in terms of, you know, in terms of the overall flow of where we're at in this sort of, you know, pandemic endgame. Like, I look through Ticketmaster and, you know, it looks pretty well sold. Like, there's a lot of tickets sold. You know, I'd say we're looking at, you know, not like 10%, maybe 10% of tickets in ticket inventory remaining here for Rogers Arena. But yeah, I mean, that's wild. Like, when have we ever said that for a Canucks home opener? Like, even when this team was bad, the home opener you knew would sell out. Right? Like, this is a different thing entirely. This is a local public confidence issue. And clearly, like, there's still work there. There's still work to be done in terms of making people feel safe to gather with 20,000 of their neighbors and support, you know, an entertainment product. Like, we're not there yet, even with the vaccine mandates, even with a 90% vaccinated population in, you know, Vancouver coastal.
And I'm curious to see what the masking situation looks like. And I know it's going to be mandatory, but having gone to other events, and you can tell me what the road trip looked like, because in Seattle, they were masked. You know, there weren't people. I mean, I'm sure there were the odd people that we didn't see trying to push back, but you could see it in the stands. You could see it in the concourses. They were masked.
They were.
Along with being vaccinated as per the requirement. And
that was not common.
We expect it to be that way in Vancouver.
That was not the general course of things for me. You know, like, there were press boxes where people were widely unmasked, to be totally honest with you, right? Like, because really the NHL protocols only require masking on the concourse. and I mean, the difference from city to city was mind blowing when I was there, right? Like, you'd go to places like Philadelphia and Chicago and Seattle where mask wearing was the way we are used to it looking in Vancouver. And then you'd go to other places where it really wasn't, like really was not, where you'd, you know, not see anyone with a mask the entire time you were out. So it's a different world, and we're not done here. Like, we're not through the woods, unfortunately. We're not going to be through the woods this winter, and how that impacts consumption, how that impacts people's desire to attend live hockey games. I mean, that's going to be something that teams and the business as a whole is contending with, certainly for the next 4 or 5 months at least, and perhaps beyond that. Hopefully not, though.
I was impressed with what I saw in Seattle, but like you, I've been to some other events. I was in Tampa, Florida for the NFL season opener, so you can only imagine what that looked like from a mask wearing standpoint. Honestly, I don't know that Boston was significantly better when I was there for the Patriots' return for Tom Brady. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what it looks like, but I fully have confidence that here in Vancouver, it's going to be fairly positive from that perspective.
Yeah, me too.
And people know what they're getting into when they walk in the door, right? There's no need to necessarily push back. In terms of the lineup, we're going to see, does Vasily Podkolzin get in? We're seeing less and less of Chiasson. And is it going to be between those two until Mott gets back in the lineup?
Well, you know, for me, it comes down to one thing that I noted after Brock Besser was put on the power play one. Not only did it score, which is always a good sign in terms of, yeah, we'll see that again, but Besser won a ton of puck battles. Like, his work on puck retrievals was diligent and assertive in 5-on-4 situations after he replaced Chiasson. And I think that was pointed, like a pointed effort that he made. Like, I want to keep the spot. I want to keep the spot. And if I have to win every puck battle to do it, I'm going to. I thought that was clear from how Besser performed in that net front role. So, you know, I if Chiasson's not on PP1, then we're looking at him playing how many minutes? Like 5-6 minutes a night? Like, Podkolzin surely can handle that, right? Like, at some point, this club can't be approaching every game like it's must win, right? Like, you need to develop Podkolzin too. I don't think the criticism of the coach and the coaching staff for removing Podkolzin for the lineup was commensurate with what he's accomplished. You know, across the board, his underlying data is probably the worst among Canucks forwards. I don't think he's been necessarily at a point where he can help a good team win games, frankly. And that's okay. He's 20 years old. Like, it's going to take some time. But I also think he's shown in flashes that he's going to get there, that he's going to be an impactful player in the NHL. And for me, everything that they do with Podkolzin should be designed to get him ramped up to that point as soon as possible. Like, I think by February, there's a real chance that he's one of Vancouver's 9 best forwards. So how do you accomplish that? The AHL game's really unstructured. I don't think necessarily he's going to pick up the types of subtleties you need him to get to that level, just from playing 20 minutes a night in an unstructured environment in the American League, where he'd probably dominate. But again, you know, is that what you want? Or do you want him to be a competent, you know, third liner for you, which is going to require him to be used to making plays off the wall at the NHL level and doing some of these subtle things that help a team connect play and retain possession, in the toughest league in the world. Like, that to me is the goal. So, you know, I mean, I've been pretty consistent here. I think they need to find a way to carve out a regular shift for him, a regular line for him, and just keep him there and let him learn, let him rack up 500 minutes of experience. And then I think you're going to see a totally different player. Now that they're at home, now that Podkolzin can't be jumped matchup wise, like I think they have to figure out a way to get him in the lineup. Like, they have to, especially before Mott comes back and necessitates a difficult decision in terms of who remains on the 23-man roster.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And I think we're going to see Podkolzin get back in the lineup as early as Tuesday night. And, you know, in terms of what we've seen from Alex Chiasson, when he's had his power play minutes, has there been enough there to warrant more?
I think so. Honestly, I've liked the power play performance from Chiasson. He's good there. I think he's been good there. I think he's been a little bit snake bit, but I think the power play has been good with him there. I think he's been good in that spot. I think he is good in that spot. But, you know, I also think that it's at its best when it's got the five guys, like the big five, right? Like Hughes, Miller, Horvat, Pettersson, Besser. And, you know, the change that I'd probably like to see at this point is Miller to go back to the net front, right? And Besser to go back to the flank. And I know that so much of what they initiate is initiated by Miller, that he's been really effective for them in that spot. But, you know, and look, I mean, the puck movement between him and Hughes was really good leading up to the Besser, or sorry, the Horvat tying goal on Saturday. Like, that was Miller and Hughes together being wildly intelligent to create that rebound. So, you know, not an urgent thing that I'm saying, like, we need to see this. Like, you know, give them some time with Besser at the net front, see what it looks like. But, you know, the next change to make, if struggles persist in terms of generating meaningful duress for penalty killing units, like, it's flopping those two for me. And, you know, I'd be curious to see what that looks like, particularly because I don't know that Miller's been at his most efficient as the primary distributor on PP1 to this point. Like, not that that's the problem with PP1 by any means. It's just that, you know, in the first six games, he hasn't been as effective in that spot, certainly as he was down the stretch in 1920, but also as he was, you know, during the 2021 season, for me anyway.
Yeah, and for Miller, I mean, he certainly wants to play based on what he's shown us to this point. I mean, he wants to play on the side as opposed to down low. I mean, whether or not he's more effective there, and when you look at his game, you'd think this is where he should be. It's not always where he necessarily wants to be or how he right. wants to play.
Well, what I like, though, about putting him low, too, is if you put him low, then between him, Horvat, and Pettersson, you have three lefties on the downhill sort of on that side of the on the right side of your 1-3-1. And for me, there's an ability for all three of them to rotate. Like, the good thing about Horvat, Miller, and Pettersson is that all of them can rip one timers, right? All of them are smart enough to find soft areas in the bumper, and all of them are pretty disciplined and brave at the net front. Like, all of them can be lethal at the net front. So you can set up this rotation between them. You have Besser's shot to play as a threat on the weak side, and you've got Quinn Hughes directing traffic, which he does so well. I mean, that to me, like, if you want rotation, if you want more movement on your power play, the easiest way to do it is to flop Miller and Besser so that Miller, Horvat, and Pettersson can read off each other and kind of switch places, create some confusion that way. For me, that's like worth trying. Like, that's if the power play remains too stationary, like, that's the most straightforward solution to it.
But we've seen that from time to time, and have we seen enough movement? Because you're right, I mean, in theory it should work that way, but it generally tends not to, even when they're in those spots.
No, I know. And with, I mean, as Newell Brown pointed out on this podcast in the summer, right, like, the lack of rotation, the lack of movement was, in his view, the biggest problem that the power play encountered. I don't know that we've seen a ton of meaningful progress, even though the power play has been productive anyway through the first six games.
Last thing before we go, I do want to, I know you touched on it earlier, and that is just the play of the blue line and how they're underwater quite often, and, you know, they get stuck. I think Oliver Ekman-Larsson has played fairly well relative to what the expectations were coming in.
Except, I think I'd go bigger with that. I'd go exceptional.
Yeah, that's fair. I like what I've seen from him. There's no question. But when you look at Poolman, when you look at Myers, what are you seeing there? And from Rathbone, I'm seeing a player confident with the puck, but there's been some growing pains, as you'd expect from him. But let's start with Myers and Poolman.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're seeing much of what we'd expect from Tyler Myers, just generally speaking. Like, the offensive push is there. You know, like, the Canucks are generating with him on the ice, probably more than they're generating with some of their other defensive options. But, you know, the defensive play, I think, is not where the Canucks want it to be in terms of using him in a matchup role. Like, that's just not who he is. And they know that. Like, they have the measure of the player, and they see him clearly as a secondary puck mover, a good veteran guy, brings a physical presence, and, you know, is more offensively inclined than defensively inclined. So his minutes scale up when the Canucks are trailing, and he typically doesn't play with Quinn Hughes, and, you know, that's how they use him. And I think that's right. Like, that's right. That's the way to use Tyler Myers. You know, I think he's been fine. I have nothing to really say about him beyond that. You know, Poolman, in terms of 5-on-5, like, isolated to 5-on-5, time on ice per game, he's still playing more than Ekman Larson, right? Like, he's still playing more than Ekman Larson, so he's still playing a top pair role for me, and I do think that's a little too much. Like, the defensive results have been there. I've really liked some of what I've seen from him, especially on in-game or late game, like end-game scenarios. I think he's been really effective for them. He's been used heavily. Like, he's done a heavy lift when the Canucks, for example, are shooting at an empty net. Like, he's logged a ton of ice time. I think he's been responsible. I just think the puck skills, you know, limit his effectiveness, and when he plays too much with Hughes, I don't love that combination overall. Hughes and Myers for me have been really good, Hughes and Ekman Larson have been really, really good, and I've liked the Rathbone Burrows pair overall, though I don't think they had their best game in Seattle. Like, that was the game where I thought you began to see the seams in terms of opponents getting behind them and grinding them down on the cycle and what have you. So, you know, I won't be shocked to see Luke Shen get in for game one against Minnesota, especially because of the offensive talent and the size that the Minnesota Wild bring in their bottom six group. That wouldn't surprise me. I didn't like the Burrows Rathbone game against Seattle personally, but overall that pair's done pretty well limiting the chances against and limiting the amount of push that their opponents are getting. I've liked Rathbone. I think Rathbone's played really well. I think his defensive game is held for the most part, bent but not broken, and that's all you want to see from him. So, I mean, overall, the way that I assess the blue line, like, there's been some really good individual performances for me. Ekman Larson's been tremendous, like a huge addition in terms of his defensive play to this point. Clearly, Vancouver's most effective and efficient defensive defender this season to this point. We'll see if that continues. I think it will. I think we're going to see the Ekman Larson bounce back this year. I think we're witnessing it in real time. But you know, as a group, I'm just seeing them get stuck too much, and you know, I don't think that's a surprise considering the overall quality of the personnel.
And what's also not a surprise is the overall quality of Tom Strange through six games with a chance to.
Oh, you're just too kind, bud.
Perfect columns on the road. You're getting to talk to players. I know it's been a good time for you, so I'm looking forward to seeing you at the rink again tomorrow, my friend.
Likewise, bud. Going to be a lot of fun to see, you know, you obviously, but also, you know, this city out at a hockey game again. Can't wait.
We're looking forward to it, and we'll join you again next week. Have we decided? Are we doing the next one on Wednesday or Friday?
Yeah, we got to recap the home opener, I think. I think that's pretty important.
There you go. So we'll be back on Wednesday. And before we let you go, we do want to let you know that Craig Anderson of the Buffalo Sabres joins Ian Mendez and Haley Salvian on the Athletic Hockey Show. Also, David Backus visits Craig Custance and Sean Gentile on the Athletic Hockey Show USA. And our good friend Eddie Lack stops by the Athletic Hockey Show with awesome. Rob Pizzo from CBC Sports and Sarah Sivian, along with Jesse Granger from The Athletic on Wednesday and their edition of The Athletic Hockey Show. As for us, we'd like to thank all of you for listening to The VanCast. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to leave a rating and a review. Subscribe to The Athletic Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts to get all of that bonus content from our entire network. Start with a 30-day free trial and then just 99 cents a month after that. And right now, get an annual subscription to The Athletic for just $3.99 a month when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. For me, Drancher, I'm off to the Emerald City again. I'll be there for Monday Night Football tonight, and I'll see you at the rink tomorrow.
Sounds good, bud. I'm really excited. Let's go.
What was it like for you to get back on the road for an extended period of time after essentially 2 years when you were in the bubble last, or a year and a half?
Yeah, it was a lot. In fact, let me just go chase down Wallace, because he was in here with me and he just stole my wife's slippers and she's on a meeting in the other room, so this is not going to go well. I need to just chase him down, actually. Let me come back and I'll answer this from the top. Sorry.
Okay.